Well, yeah, you're going to give your talk from here and then.
Yeah,
and your talk
from there, and there's my text,
your talk.
Including my one of my own.
Okay, we got to have those. Go ahead. Well, thank you all so very much for being such an attentive and lively audience. I'm Alan Wolf, the director of the Boise Center, and our previous people who've done introductions have thanked all the relevant people at Boston College, but I want to particularly thank Eric Owens, the associate director of the Boise Center, for the amazing amount of work that he did, and working with Owen, with Eric, and cooperating with him is just one of the joys of my life. Thanks so much, Eric. Well, I like to believe that we all have our own favorite newspaper columnists, and I can say right away that E.J. Dionne is mine. E.J. is widely known as a liberal. It's fine with me, I'm sort of one myself, but we live at a time, especially when journalists in the District of Columbia tend to frown on anyone with strong political convictions. In this very, very cynical age dominated by online publications such as Politico and BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed is sort of like Politico on stilts. The key is to be thoroughly cynical. You're only supposed to cover what journalists call the horse race aspects of a campaign. You're not allowed at all whatsoever to write about or care about public policy, which is an automatic disqualification in what bloggers sarcastically refer to as the village and what other people call our town, as in you'll never have lunch in our town again. In such an atmosphere, there's something wonderfully old-fashioned about a man who cares where his country is going and is concerned that it is not living up to its best potential. Yet ask anyone in the District of Columbia of any ideological or partisan inclination about E.J. Dionne, and you will find nothing but respect for this man. I know, I've done that. I've asked people across the political spectrum, even people at Politico, what they think of E.J. Dionne. And the answer is always, well, he's simply the nicest guy here. That's all there is to it. So our speaker, believe me, is unique. He is the great exception to the way journalism works in Washington these days, because no one questions his honesty and his sincerity. And in that sense, he's just the perfect person to address us today on this incredibly important theme. Now, I should say that I want to talk about myself, but I have one job, and it kind of keeps me busy. EJ has about three or four. I can't keep count of them all. He's not only a journalist and a columnist at the Washington Post. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's a professor of government at Georgetown University, and he's a frequent commentator on politics for National Public Radio, ABC's This Week, and NBC's Meet the Press. I've known him for an incredibly long time. We were able to get him here to do this for us. I just considered it a feather in our cap. E.J. Dionne, please, let's hear what you have to say.
Well, I want to announce that I'm scrapping the talk I was going to give, and I'm just going to give a talk on how much I love Alan Wolf. That was so sweet. I do have a lot of jobs. Those of you at a university will know I have two kids now in college and a third still on the way, and my wife has a job, so we need a lot of jobs at this time. I always like to say when I get a nice introduction like that, the one I got that once ended, and now for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dionne. So that was not only better than that, but just incredibly generous. I am really honored to be here today because there are so many people here that I admire. And speaking as a Catholic and as a professor at another Jesuit university, I really want to thank Boston College, and in particular the Boise Center, for all the extraordinary work they do on the public witness of faith. And I was told that one of the reasons that I was chosen is because I grew up in Massachusetts. Now, I'd like to assume that that is because Massachusetts has always been so good at upholding the common good, and it clearly did so recently. I am an over-the-moon Red Sox fan, I have to say, and I still haven't gotten over that. But I also thought that maybe it's because Massachusetts is one of those places where people always ask the question, what are you? And people know what they're talking about. It's usually, what are you? And the answer is Italian, Irish, Polish, or whatever. Or what are you? It's Catholic, some kind of Protestant, or Jewish, or Muslim. Kevin Phillips, actually, the great Republican political analyst, although now really a maverick political analyst, once said that politics is really about who hates whom. And I am sorry to say that occasionally my dear state of Massachusetts fell into that. So I suppose that would qualify me to talk about diversity. And the person I want to begin by paying tribute to is Father Andrew Greeley, a great sociologist as well as a great priest. But he influenced me a lot when I was an undergrad. And one of the books he wrote had a title that has haunted me all my life. And it's a book some of you may remember. The book was called Why Can't They Be Like Us? And I was thinking that Father Greeley's title really very much goes to what we are talking about today, because we ask that question too often. We almost never ask, why can't we be like them, except maybe out of envy or jealousy. I also have to say it's generous of you to have someone who has worked as a journalist and, yes, as a political pundit to speak with you today, especially in light of the words of Pope Francis. He has offered a warning that should strike fear in the hearts of pundits and columnists everywhere. And here's what the Pope said. He said in that famous August interview with La Civiltà Cattolica, reprinted in America magazine, if one has the answers to all the questions, that is proof that God is not with him. And you realize that would put us all out of business in my line of work, which may just prove that God is not with us. But I also think that delightful rebuke to know-it-alls everywhere provides a clue as to how someone who has held the papal office only since January has already revolutionized the world's view of the Catholic Church. At a time when religion has come to be seen as synonymous with dogmatic certainty, and in the eyes of many secular observers, fundamentalism, here is arguably the most visible religious leader in the world asserting that questions, not answers, can inspire a vibrant faith. And I think there is much to learn from Pope Francis on the subject we have been discussing here. And I confess that, like so many more liberal or progressive Catholics, I can get giddy just quoting him, especially on the common good. But I'll get back to that before I close. First, I want to make the simplest point of all, which so many of you have touched on in the course of the day. We know that the best form of ecumenism, the best way to tear down barriers of suspicion and mistrust across religious lines, is for people of goodwill in all faith traditions and none to work together in service to the common good, in service to others, particularly to the marginalized, the needy, and the endangered. In this sense, I really liked Laurie Patton's idea of pragmatic pluralism. I think Marie Griffith put it well, and she knows that I like this passage of hers. She wrote this, and I think what she wrote also underscores that this kind of work can run across political lines as well, which these days are even harder to break through than religion's wall. Marie wrote some years ago, "Concern and compassion are evident today in both liberal and conservative religious circles, as witnessed by the widespread attention," and this was at the time, "to the crisis in Darfur and the global catastrophe wreaked by AIDS. In these and many other global causes, American Christians and Jews have worked alongside Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and Sikhs and other religious parties whom many once would have shunned and with whom they may continue to disagree theologically." She went on, "Advocates of religious pluralism point to this array of dramatic encounters and collaborative work among disparate religious parties is proof that strong religious adherence begets not only violent conflict, but also dynamic partnerships along partisan lines. And it would actually be lovely to devote an entire talk to such partnerships. They are happening right now as we meet here in the Philippines, as human beings give help and comfort to those suffering from an unimaginable disaster. They are happening across our country in homeless shelters and schools, senior centers, community development projects, soup kitchens, parks and gyms, hospitals and hospices. But alas, as the discussion at this conference has shown, matters are never that simple. There is first the difficulty of reaching agreement on the proper role of faith in the public sphere of a free and pluralistic society, and also on the very meaning of the idea of the common good. Reporters who have covered papal travels, as I once did with Pope John Paul II, regularly ransack the pontiff's sermons for the political angle that might interest their editors at home. I confess they also like it when popes talk about sex. But I was on a trip with a pope that a pope took to Africa back in the 1980s, and a friend who was a great wire service reporter, as he was reading through this packet of papal speeches, complained loudly, partly tongue-in-cheek, although he was describing what was a real problem for journalists. He said he didn't know what to write because, quotes, "there's nothing but religion here." This about a set of speeches by the Supreme Pontiff. Now, over the years, I have wondered if that phrase, "there is nothing but religion here," was actually a description of one or another of the American presidential campaigns that I was covering. That was especially true back in 2000 or 2004. And I think a lot of you will remember this. It was one of the most famous personal declarations of faith in our in political history, and it came from George W. Bush early in the 2000 presidential campaign. A moderator in a debate in Iowa asked each of the Republican candidates to name the political philosopher or thinker with whom he most identified. And I think you all know where this goes. Bush replied crisply and perhaps a bit abruptly, "Christ, because he changed my heart." Now, Bush was not alone in naming Jesus that time. Indeed, once he did, everybody else had to fall in line and name Jesus too. Gary Bauer actually went to policy, and he cited Christ's commands to help the hungry, the thirsty, and the poor as a guide to social policy. Orrin Hatch agreed with Bush in seeing Jesus as a guide, but added this interesting aside. Hatch said, "I think that goes without saying." Now, Hatch's comment actually went to the heart of the controversy that Bush unleashed. Are we better off when a candidate's religious faith goes without saying? Would it be better for religious tolerance and religious pluralism if all candidates were to stand with Democrat Bill Bradley, who also ran that year, as you remember, and said in a debate with Al Gore that while he would never criticize anyone else's, quotes, open expression of their faith, he had a different view. "I've decided," Bradley said, "that personal faith is private and I will not discuss it with the public." Now, Alan Wolf, and these are not panders to Alan. I quote Alan twice in my talk, but they were very, he's taught me a great deal more than this over the years. But Alan had a wonderful way of describing the peculiarly American confusion over religion and public life when he said this. He said, 200 years after the brilliant writings of Madison and Jefferson on the topic, Americans cannot make up their minds whether religion is primarily private, public, or some uneasy combination of the two. Now, I think it is surely a legitimate public issue if a candidate's religious convictions will affect the way he or she will govern. Isn't that something all of us should want to know? My friend Brian Hare told me at the time, and I always turn to Brian for wisdom on hard questions, as some in this group will be doing this evening. In principle, Brian said, it's appropriate for a religious candidate to make known and explain his religious convictions. It leads to a richer and more informed public debate. But like many at that time, I was deeply bothered by the way Bush made his Des Moines Declaration. Unlike Bauer, Bush did not explain how Christ's teachings affected his view of policy. I might note, by the way, for the theologians in the crowd, that perhaps the best response from Bush came from Alan Keyes. Remember Alan Keyes, who ran for president that year? He said, Jesus isn't a philosopher. Jesus is the Word. But I was I was sort of even more put off by Bush's reply to a follow-up question asking him to tell viewers how Jesus had changed his heart. And Bush replied, well, if they don't know, it's going to be hard to explain. Now, as a Catholic, I found these words exclusionary and even condescending, that if you didn't have his specific kind of religious experience, he couldn't possibly explain to you what you couldn't understand. My reaction turned out to be typical, as many of you know. In the post-debate commentary, the harshest attacks on Bush's statements came from Catholics, Jews, and others outside the evangelical orbit. On the other hand, many evangelical Protestants were just as put off by the attacks on what Bush said. They saw the criticism as an assault on their own forms of religious expression. That's how we talk about our faith, said a Southern Baptist friend who happened to be a staunch Democrat and had no particular use for Bush as a presidential candidate, but she found himself defending his Iowa remarks because they were so intimately connected to the way she described her faith herself. Bush, my conservative friend Mike Cromarty said at the time, was describing a personal existential subjective experience that was real for him, but was put in a language and terminology unfamiliar to the Jewish religious experience and the Catholic religious experience. Now, I'd insist that one price of religious freedom in a diverse society is that if political candidates choose to express their religious views to us, they have an obligation to explain themselves in ways that are accessible to all of us and to provide information that has a bearing on how they would govern. That actually is why Gary Bauer's answer, I think, was philosophically and politically better than Bush's answer was. Again, Father Hare, religion is certainly about the heart, but it's about more than the heart. It's about an intellectual structure of belief, and a candidate needs to explain what that intellectual structure is about, and that was totally missing from Bush's answer. So by all means, I say, let candidates be candid in sharing their religious convictions, and may the rest of us be respectful. But once candidates choose this path, they need to explain exactly why the information is relevant to whether we should make them president. So one point I want to underscore is that religious freedom, pluralism, and tolerance impose dual obligations. And I think that each of these tends to be more congenial to one side of our political debate than the other. On the one hand, it is entirely legitimate for religious citizens and politicians to bring their faith to the public square. That is an essential right to freedom of expression. I once debated Ralph Reed, then of the Christian Coalition, and I said that I would always defend Ralph's right to base his political mission, his political witness, on his religious beliefs, because in many ways my views were shaped by my religious tradition, though I did ask Ralph to explain to me where Jesus called for a cut in the capital gains tax. I just could not find that in my New Testament. But I think the other side is that pluralism demands that we, and that's politicians, but also we citizens, make our views intelligible to those who are not part of our own tradition, and that we advance arguments that speak to the entire community. I may believe that my faith and its definition of the common good creates an obligation to the poor that includes action by government. I actually do believe that. But I don't think it is sufficient for me to say that others should support, say, universal health coverage because Jesus or Micah or Amos would say that we must do so. We might well use Jesus or Micah or Amos to explain ourselves, to give our case power, to give it poetry, to give it the sanction of tradition. We might well challenge those inside our own tradition who disagree with us to square their own views with what the tradition teaches, and they have a right to do that with us. But when talking to a libertarian agnostic or to someone who is spiritual but not religious, we must make our case in terms that they can accept. One model I think is always worth revisiting and reviving, and I think is very relevant to our moment again, is what might be called civil rights Christianity. Its approach to the common good was resolutely centered not on the defeat of adversaries, but on their conversion. Not conversion to a particular faith, but to a new personal and social ethic. Civil rights Christianity spoke, in Dr. King's words, of speeding the day, and I wish I could speak like Dr. King, when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. Civil rights Christianity helped create a movement, many of whose heroes came from outside the Christian tradition. Some of those heroes were in fact atheists. And in spawning a broad, open, faith-inspired movement, and also Declaration of Independence-inspired movement, it showed that tolerance and pluralism did not lead inexorably down a road to relativism. It was a movement whose values were clear and whose call to civic virtue and equality was tough and persistent and inspiring. The end is redemption and reconciliation, King declared at the beginning of his own ministry in 1957. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community, while the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. The beloved community, that wonderful phrase, I think has always been one of the most powerful definitions of the purpose of a politics of the common good. Yet we need to be careful here. There is a temptation to see ecumenical efforts in the political sphere as always a form of progress, especially when those ecumenical efforts advance the political cause of the side we happen to be on ourselves. In fact, I learned something important about this some years ago from Alan, and I learned it in an interesting way because it was actually something Alan wrote in a very kind and warm-hearted response to what's something I had written. But it was a challenge that has stayed with me ever since, and it's a challenge I've since thrown out to lots of other people, which is why I want to share it with you here. The danger, I think, is first that we could be replacing old forms of religious division with new forms of political division. And moreover, in the process, we might subjugate and marginalize faith itself by putting it to the service of politics. Here is what Alan wrote. He said, my first concern with a certain approach to religion and public life is that it downplays the significance of the very phenomenon being used to explain what is happening in the United States, religion itself. It may be true that some people attach so much importance to their views on abortion, capital punishment, or gay marriage that they seek allies in other religious traditions. But if so, it is their political views, their take on public policy, that they are putting first, with their theology or religious practice coming second. At earlier periods in American history, people have argued over which Bible should be read in schools and how it should be interpreted. Those were debates that put theology first. The people who fight today's culture war, by contrast, he went on, put politics first. It is not their stance on what God wants that determines the party for which they vote. They know what they believe on political matters, and they pick a party just as they pick a denomination. And he went on, at some point, people who line up this way and begin to put their political convictions ahead of their theological beliefs will have to ask, scratch their heads and ask, is this what we are really about? We came to religion to express our spirituality and find out about the nature of the divinity, yet here we are being urged by our pastors to vote for tax cuts and the war in Iraq. Such a shift in priorities cannot be all that satisfying to a genuine religious believer. Now, this is very complicated because I have found over the years that if you happen to agree with what a preacher says on a political matter, you see that preacher as a prophet. If you happen to disagree with what a preacher says on a political matter, you see him as descending into vulgar politics. And I do think there is a place for preachers in politics, or why else would I honor Dr. Martin Luther King? But I think that Alan's warning is actually one that goes back quite a ways, and some of you may be as fond of this as I am, as C.S. Lewis's great observation that many turn to the scripture not for guidance on political matters, rather they ransack scripture in search of support for the views of their own political party. And so I think that's another area where we need great care. Alan's point underscores another problem that Michael Ignatieff brought alive for me in his just published book, Fire and Ashes, that I recommend to you. It's about Ignatieff's experiences as leader of the Canadian Liberal Party. And as the title suggests, it was actually a rough experience for this academic who had the courage to go into the political sphere. His Liberal Party suffered an absolutely devastating defeat in the 2011 elections. But Ignatieff has now used his own experience for the purpose of instruction, proving that he is a good teacher. And he raises a question I think in this discussion we are having here we really need to confront. That is the question of standing. It's the word that fascinated him, and the more I read it, fascinated me. He argued that one of the most insidious tendencies in politics, but we might also say, and I was particularly struck by this in the discussion of the last panel, in discussions of religion, is the rush to deny standing to those whom we disagree with. Here's how Ignatieff explains this. Standing, he wrote, is a word from the law that means you have the right to have your day in court. Granting standing is not displaying deference. It is showing democratic respect. And we today might also add, it is showing spiritual respect. Ignatieff goes on, in the degraded politics we are enduring, the explicit goal of attack is to avoid debate, to avoid the risks that go with a free exchange of ideas. Once you have denied a person standing, you no longer have to rebut what they say. You only have to tarnish who they are. In this perversion of the game, Ignatieff says, politics is modeled as war itself. The aim is not to defeat an adversary, but to destroy an enemy by denying him standing. We need to attend carefully to where all the loose macho talk about politics as war can lead. War, Karl von Clausewitz said, was the continuation of politics by other means, but politics is not the continuation of war. It is the alternative to it. We care about politics, defend it, seek to preserve its vitality because its purpose is to save us from the very worst. I think that's a very helpful view of politics, and I think it's a reminder to religious people who care about the common good that how we engage in politics can have as much to do with the common good as what we fight for in the political realm. And yes, I think politics is inevitably part of the pursuit of the common good. Fleeing politics is not an option, meaning that all of us must be willing with Dietrich Bonhoeffer to have dirty hands while also hoping that we will not in the process lose our souls. Bonhoeffer knew this was not easy, and he gave his life as part of this witness. But as promised, I want to close by talking a bit more about Pope Francis, because as I said at the outset, he does have a great deal to teach us in this area. First, let us not pretend that Pope Francis is anything but an Orthodox Catholic. Francis is Orthodox, all right. He has reasserted the Church's clear teaching on abortion, clear as his words, and said he could not do otherwise. "I am a son of the Church," he explained. But he is an Orthodox searcher who wants to share the journey with anyone of goodwill, including non-believers, who takes the quest for truth seriously. "Who am I to judge?" he replied in that famous moment when he was asked his view of those who are gay. Now, for so many of us, judging is precisely what a pope does for a living, so it was a rather remarkable statement. Francis did not change church doctrine with that statement. He merely changed virtually everything about how we see the role of a pope and, in many ways, how we see the church itself. A pope who sees lifting up the poor and moralizing an unjust economy as primary objectives in our search for the common good inevitably views the culture wars that have engaged many of our more conservative brethren, particularly in the United States, is a peculiar rock on which to build the church's public ministry. This view has brought him criticism from some on the Catholic right, as he acknowledged himself. But putting the culture war in its place is consistent with a papacy that finds its inspiration in the global South, outside the ongoing arguments among liberals and traditionalists in the developed world. I quote Pope Francis again: "We cannot insist only on issues related to abortion, gay marriage, and the use of contraceptive methods. This is not possible," he said in that famous interview. "I have not spoken much about these things, and I was reprimanded for that. But when we speak about these issues, we have to talk about them in a context. The dogmatic moral and moral teachings of the church are not all equivalent. The church's pastoral ministry cannot be obsessed with the transmission of a disjointed multitude of doctrines to be imposed insistently." Again, a remarkable statement from a pope, a disjointed multitude of doctrines. "We have," he says, "to find a new balance. Otherwise, even the moral edifice of the church is likely to fall like a house of cards, losing the freshness and fragrance of the gospel." I love that freshness and fragrance. He seems to want to move the church outward from the nave of a dark cathedral to the bright garden outside its doors. And yes, as he has said many times, to the streets. Again, no change in doctrine, but a major change in emphasis that has profound implications. Now, much is expected of this pope, including serious reform of the Vatican, a substantial decentralization of authority, a definitive reckoning with the pedophilia scandal, and among Western Catholics especially, American Catholics in particular, I think, a broadening of the opportunities for a stronger presence of women in the church, in Pope Francis's own words. In global terms, however, here may be the central paradox of his papacy. As the leader of a church that has so long been viewed as dogmatic, hierarchical, and traditional, Francis bids to turn himself into a model of a kind of mystical humility that combines a spirit of moderation with intellectual openness and a radical understanding of what the primacy of the spiritual over the material can mean. Pope Benedict issued a stern warning against a dictatorship of relativism. Francis seems worried about something else entirely. And he said, "If the Christian is a restorationist, a legalist, if he wants everything to be clear and safe, then he will find nothing. Tradition and memory of the past help us to have the courage to open new areas to God. Those who today always look for disciplinarian solutions. Those who long for an exaggerated doctrinal security, those who stubbornly try to recover a past that no longer exists, they have a static and inward-directed view of things. In this way, faith becomes an ideology among ideologies. I have a dogmatic certainty: God is present in every person's life. Thus, his one dogmatic certainty is a thoroughly undogmatic universalism, more interested in shattering barriers than in erecting them, more interested in winning converts than in hunting heretics. Now, I realized going through my text here that I did leave out one point that I want to make before I close, and this came up again in the conversation we were having, and that is the problem posed to friends of pluralism and religious liberty among those who do not accept religious pluralism and liberty. And I do believe there is an obligation for those of us who believe in religious freedom to stand up for it. One could argue that it's to try to be nice in the face of these challenges, and I think Randall Kennedy brought this up, may actually sound like it's in keeping with Jesus' call upon us to turn the other cheek. But I think we shouldn't look at this as standing up for ourselves. I think it's an act of solidarity to stand up for the religious freedom of others. But following Michael Ignatieff, I also think that it is very important not to use the assertions of some in favor of the repression of religious freedom against those, all members of a particular tradition, to deny them and all of the members of their tradition standing in our public discussion. I think Laurie made this point that those of us who are Catholic especially, I think, should be especially sensitive to what many of our Muslim brothers and sisters face, Muslim brothers and sisters who share our belief in religious liberty, but are ruled out of the conversation because others view our tradition as authoritarian and opposed to religious freedom. That is exactly what happened to Catholics in the past. So again, I think we need a kind of balance here where we must stand up against religious repression, but we cannot pretend that this is the part of any single tradition, and we can't deny standing to those in traditions where some members take this, as it were, dogmatic view against religious liberty. So here we have a pope whose one dogmatic certainty is a thoroughly undogmatic universalism, an undogmatic universalism that sees God in every person. That is the rock on which we can build the common good, on which we can build openness, tolerance, and ecumenism. That is the rock on which we can build a faith that proclaims that all of us should be free at last, free at last, thanks to God Almighty. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Either one. So our procedure will be for me to be an interlocutor for a moment, ask a few questions, and then open it up to the audience. Thanks so much for that great talk. I just have one comment. I mean, you remarked, and especially at the start, about Bush introducing his evangelical faith into politics and various kinds of reactions. And I kind of come down the same place that you did on it, where, you know, as discomforting as it first was to hear him say that for me, for him to talk about that faith, I'm more like the Bradley kind of thing, that it should be your own business. It was discomforting, but then I recall, what's the alternative? I mean, the alternative is that we don't know anything. And, you know, we had that experience. We had that experience in 1960, when one of our presidential candidates had to go to great lengths to deny his own religiosity and his membership in his own church. And I mean, of course, Richard Nixon. It wasn't, everyone knew that Kennedy was a Catholic, but Nixon never talked much about being a Quaker. so for a long period of time, we were simply deprived of that information. I wonder how many people in the room know what the religion of Hubert Humphrey was, or how many people in the room knew what the religion of Spyro Agnew was. Well, Agnew's a great one, right? I don't think anybody.
He had to be Greek Orthodox.
No, of course he wasn't. See, I got him wrong.
He was an Episcopalian.
He was an Episcopalian, exactly. He was an Episcopalian. You know, so it is better off, I think, that we know these things, that even if we have to pay somewhat of an uncomfortable price. And the other just comment I had, I've never seen a politician as uncomfortable with this issue as Mitt Romney. That his speech about his faith was, I'm not really a Mormon, I'm an evangelical. That's how I interpreted that. He just went out of his way to try to make his Mormon, to tailor his beliefs to his, and I just thought that was sad, basically. I don't know, given the fact that Mormons have probably been the most hostily received religion inside the United States, more than I would say, Mormons were hated more than Muslims are hated now. That given that level of intolerance, maybe he had no choice but to do that.
Could I say a couple things? One is, when going back to Kennedy, is my mic on? Oh, I have to turn it on.
A little green light comes.
There. Now I detached myself. One of the things that's always struck me, and I think we've talked about this in the past, was the difference between John Kennedy and Joe Lieberman in the way in which they dealt with their faith publicly. And there are a lot of ironies there that, in order to gain votes from evangelical Christians, Kennedy essentially had to argue that his Catholic faith would have nothing to do with how he governed as president. And that extraordinary speech he gave at the Houston Ministers was really about creating, as it were, a wall of separation between his faith and how he would act in office. Joe Lieberman, the first Jew to be nominated for either president or vice president, in 2000 took an entirely different approach, and he was extremely open in talking about his faith. And one of the ironies is that people at the time said that one of the, I believe it was authentic and about who Joe Lieberman was, and I actually believe it was also authentic in Kennedy's case, where, as Arthur Schlesinger said, it was impossible to find any really organic connection between Kennedy's faith and his view of public life. But people at the time said, Lieberman is doing this to curry favor with evangelicals. And it just showed how different the country was in 1960 when evangelicals wanted the assurance that faith would be separated from politics, and 2000 when their main fear of liberals is that liberals and Democrats couldn't stand religion. On Romney, Romney was much more reticent this time than he was in the earlier election. Romney gave a very interesting speech, I guess it was the end of 2007, on religious freedom and his role as a Mormon. And the biggest problem with this speech is there was an utter disjuncture between the two halves of the speech. The first half of the speech was actually a very good, very effective defense of religious pluralism, and an invitation to voters, much like Kennedy's, not to hold his religion against him, in an argument that this was not a thing Americans should do. But the second half of the speech, because the votes he was looking for were from evangelicals in Iowa, was much more a declaration that sounded like he broadly agreed that America was a Christian nation. I never quite said that, and I'm putting words in his mouth, but the two halves didn't go together. And one of the reasons I think he was so reluctant to talk about it in his second campaign is he realized that he was stuck in this bind where he needed to say certain things to get votes from religious conservatives, but he needed to say other things to reassure on Mormonism. But in the end, I think it was a great loss to him. Probably most of you didn't watch almost every moment of the Republican convention. I actually had to watch almost every moment of the Republican convention, and I am a curious sort of person. I actually enjoyed doing these things. But one of the greatest testimonies to Mitt Romney actually was at the Republican convention when a whole group of Mormons whom he had helped in a very personal way over the years came up and gave testimony to what Romney had done for them. And it gave him, you really sense this is somewhere in there is a very compassionate person. David Brooks, our friend, said it should be campaign malpractice that he never brought these folks to a wider audience. But there was the fear of being a Mormon and how that would affect
the voters. So I actually think, I still think Obama would have won that election for a variety of other reasons, but I think Romney would have presented a much fuller view of who he actually is if he had felt the freedom to talk a little bit more about his faith.
Yeah, I mean, another one of these markers about how the country has changed may be the campaign of George Romney compared to the campaign of Mitt Romney, that we weren't as focused on religion in those days, which enabled George Romney to essentially avoid the Mormonism issue.
I had a great student who wrote a paper on this.
Oh, really? Wow.
And the student there were a variety of interesting things. One was that George Romney refused to raise any money through Mormon networks. Mm-hmm. And also, as some of you know, that George Romney was a real reformer inside Mormonism because he was an ardent advocate of racial justice. And you're right, it was, and we weren't asking the question. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had the theory that one of the things that elected John Kennedy were World War II movies. And if you remember,
Frank Sinatra, always playing.
Yes, and there was always usually an Italian, a Jew, an Irish guy, occasionally an African American, although that was to come. And also, we were fighting Nazis and religious intolerance. And so there was a kind of change that came across the country that sort of affected the way we talked about religion publicly. And I think that continued when George Romney ran for president, where we had just gone through this awful experience. With Kennedy's Catholicism mm-hmm. being used against him, and we didn't want to do it again. Although poor George Romney's candidacy imploded so early that we never know how that would have played out in the end.
EJ, you spoke so eloquently about Pope Francis, and that was a surprise. I thought we were bringing you here to talk about gridlock and partisanship and division and so on. So I'm going to ask a question that tries to link what you said about Francis to
this, gridlock.
To the That's gridlock, exactly.
Only Alan Wolfe could pull that off, I want you to know.
What Francis has done is to remind us that humility is a wonderful virtue, and that its opposite, arrogance, pretension, whatever you want to call it, is a vice, or if one is religiously inclined, is sin. And one of the things that really strikes me about the gridlock in Washington is the total absence of humility. That you can talk about it as, people being ideological. I actually think it's worse than I think ideologists can actually compromise. I think this lack of compromise is something worse than ideological. But I keep looking for the language, to how do we get into this kind of situation. And it does strike me that a complete absence of what Francis has demonstrated is much, seems to dominate, not only the language, but the attitudes, the body language, almost everything. Going on, I wonder how we got there. I mean, our Constitution was the product primarily of the brilliance of James Madison, who, while not an overtly religious figure, was steeped in Calvinist tradition. He understood that ambition must be made to counter ambition. He understood that that ambition was a sin in that sense. He was enough of a skeptic about human nature to recognize that it was a sin so deeply entrenched in us that we couldn't change human nature. But we could at least have ambition counter so that, there would be some kind of, we could control it rather than eliminating it from our nature as human beings. So the whole American experiment, in a sense, was brought about by a recognition, if you want, of our sinfulness. And here we are, we're supposedly this religious country, and supposedly we have this very deeply committed party that talks about its religious base. And yet sin is entirely selective now. So that sin is what happens in the bedroom. Sin is not about arrogance or not about an unyielding quest and lust for power or for wealth or for anything. Do you have any sense of how we got that way that we can now have almost this cafeteria style? Oh, that sin? No, we're not going to talk about that. I have to say Eric and I got very deeply involved in this when we held a big conference here that resulted in a book about gambling. Because it had always struck me, why didn't gambling become an issue the way abortion or some other, became? Billy Sunday devoted his entire ministry to anti-gambling. Anti-gambling was once part of the evangelical. It was a sin. And now all of a sudden it's in every state, and it's an alternative to taxation. How do we get selective like that in our sins?
Well, I think in the gambling's case, it's because taxation came to be seen as a bigger sin than gambling.
Yeah, well.
But it is. Actually, it's one of the, gambling is legal gambling, I should say. First of all, the absurdity, asking a political columnist to talk about humility is like asking a Yankees fan to pay tribute to how great the 2013 Red Sox were.
By the way, the last time I saw him was on the Acela when he was taking his kid to a Red Sox game. All the way, and on the train, no less.
Yeah.
Or was it the plane?
What?
No, it might have been the plane. All right, go.
Yeah. Yes, we got to this one, my son and I. A point, you said a couple of things. One was about gambling, but
I'm really wondering, could there be, in this current situation of gridlock, where, you know, we're all so disturbed and depressed about it, could there be religious voices that could remind us?
Yeah, what I wanted to say first was that the one issue on which I actually had my mind changed listening to a legislative debate when I was covering the New York State Legislature was gambling. And it was very interesting because the speech that influenced my view was given by somebody who happened to be a minister named Carl McCall, who was a state senator from Harlem. But Carl McCall did not get up and talk about gambling itself as inherently evil. He actually talked about, if you will, the social sins that the proliferation of gambling created, what it did to communities, what it did to people who lived in those communities, attacks on the poor. And I had always taken a kind of libertarian view on gambling, which is people are going to do it. Why do we have these laws? And at the end of Carl McCall's speech, I actually said, no, there is something about the spread of gambling that should worry us all. And so I always said one of the few issues I agreed with Ralph Reed on was gambling until I later learned that he did some work with some casinos on the side. But
I'm with Jack, Abramoff.
But the problem on arrogance, the other thing I've started to think about is maybe we're too tough on Ted Cruz on this front, because here's a guy who went to Harvard, to Princeton, and is a member of the Tea Party. So he's got a lot to fight if he wants to overcome arrogance, you know? And I'm guilty of one of those myself, so I say it as a fellow sinner. But I think a lot of our politics for 40 years has been a battle over which sins matter most. But none of the sins that we have argued about have to do with arrogance, so that people on the left tend to talk about the sins of intolerance, discrimination, sexism. People on the right tend to talk more about sins of a personal lack of discipline, we'll say, whether we're talking about abortion or sexuality. And this is a very peculiar kind of, first of all, I'm not sure it's a highly productive way to construct politics. It's certainly not a very good way to try to figure out what the common good is, because inevitably you are pushing one side, you're essentially consigning one side or the other to the, you know, depths of hell, because they are sinners. So I think that's sort of an inherent problem. But I do wonder what's happened to a theology of humility. I mean, that when you go back to World War II era and the Cold War era, one of the greatest things about the influence of Reinhold Niebuhr was precisely that he brought kind of St. Augustine into the public conversation of the United States, and having a sense of both the nation's possible failings and our own personal failings was very much what was a real problem. Niebuhr, as many of you know, once said, although he insisted he got it from somebody else, no plagiarist he, that original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian church. And that's a very useful view. And in particular, he got liberals to think about flawed human nature. We liberals tend to believe a lot in the perfectibility of human nature. And I've always thought, maybe because I'm a Catholic, that Niebuhr was closer to right, and that we could make progress, that salvation, if you will, is possible, but we need to accept this frailty. And we seem to have lost that. Obama, ironically, does have, has shown a real Niebuhrian sense. I mean, he seems to have studied Niebuhr and taken him seriously. And he talks in a way where you don't sense it's not a passing read one excellent article on Niebuhr thing. Maybe that does explain aspects of his foreign policy that some people aren't actually comfortable with.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. I'm absolutely persuaded that he has read Niebuhr closely. Yeah. You can see it in his speeches. You can see it in his action. I have one last question before opening it up. I was touched and thrilled that you were able to mention that critique I wrote of a talk you gave at the Brookings Institution, you know, where I tried to say, well, at some point if they, you know, make these so-called political issues central, what's going to happen to the spirituality? What's going to happen to the very sense of wonder about God that drew people to religion in the first place? I'd have to say, and I hope you'll confirm me, that's right, here, that I sense more and more that that's actually happening out there in the country, that the political, when we think of the so-called Christians who made politics central to their world, of course, Jerry Falwell isn't with us, but we have Pat Robertson and so on, that there's just that just doesn't appeal to younger generations, even from their own religious traditions. You know, that there's a sense that we really took the wrong step, you know, by going down that road, and we want the faith back.
Well, I think, you know, Bob Putnam and David Campbell in their great book on American religion really make the point that it should be actually very scary for people in our great institutions of organized religion where young people are right now, because the under 30 generation is the least churched or synagogued or mosqued, the least attached to religion of any generation. And it's not, you know, we always say, well, young people sort of stray from religion, then come back when they have kids because their kids got to get values from somewhere. But the fact is, if you look at this cohort, you're talking numbers of about 35% who declare that they are not attached to religion, or the nuns, not like nuns on the bus, but N-O-N-E-S. That's 35%, much higher than a generation or two ago of people who are under 30. And Putnam and Campbell argue that it is precisely the close association of organized religion with a very particular kind of right-wing politics that has turned off this generation, which is actually the most liberal generation to come along since the New Deal generation, partly because they are also the most diverse generation racially and ethnically that's come along. But that rise of the nuns is a real challenge to people who run religious institutions. And it's why, you know, Catholics could well claim that, you know, Francis came along just in time and is the work of the Holy Spirit, because Francis's way of preaching and of talking about the Christian faith, the Catholic faith, I think has so much more reach to younger believers. And I also think he may have a particular mission to ex-Catholics, who, as many of you know, are the third largest denomination in the United States. And I think that there are people who are giving the church a second look because of Francis. I had this experience last night. I took my son out to dinner, and at one point we talked about Francis, and there was an excitement. And, you know, in all honesty, you do not see a lot of excitement about religion among 21-year-old boys, you know, young men. And, you know, there was something about Francis that's grabbing him. And so I think it's good for the church for a whole variety of reasons, but I think particularly on the front you're talking about, it's important. In terms of religious right, they're still there. They still organize a very significant wing of the Republican Party, partly because a lot of the Republican moderates have left the party. So their share of the party in primaries is very considerable. But I think, and I'd ask you to check me on this, but I think, you know, Putnam's research and the research of a lot of other people suggests the big evangelical wave in general crested around 1990. And they're not losing ground,
roughly,
but they're
not
gaining.
Roughly when the media discovered it, right? When the media discovered it.
And also when academia discovered it. You know, we're both. My wife is a lawyer, and I always thank her for that, because lawyers are the only people who sometimes keep journalists out of the cellar in that evaluation of honored professions in the United States.
I could keep talking to you forever, but I think Connor and Ben have the microphones, right? And we have some time for a few comments. Please make them to him, not to me.
Actually, I'll turn them back to him.
Back there.
Yes, my name is Ray Mack. I'm from West Bridgewater.
Oh, excellent. My mom went to Bridgewater State.
See, there you go. I don't have a question, and I don't have a statement, but I have a request. Your speech was phenomenal. You said so much in such a short period of time, I couldn't take it all in.
I talk way too fast.
Well, no, it was wonderful. Are you going to be putting that in the Washington Post, or is there a way that I can get a copy of it?
Somehow I'll figure it out with these gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's very sweet of you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
God, I hope they're all that easy. Bless you.
You're next.
Thank you so much. I agree. It was a wonderful talk. And I guess going on this humility point, I was thinking, you're here, you are such a valuable part of the media culture precisely because you do show humility, and it's so rare, and it's part of why we admire you. You're both, you know, brilliant in the things you say, but you're also very humble. So, present company excluded, the media culture around you, and particularly cable news and all of that, does not cultivate, shall we say, any kind of atmosphere of humility. And I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on that. How do we even cultivate this, given the kind of noise that there is out there that we're all getting our news from? And also that the media is so focused on strategy all the time, including the shows that you're on, I think. It's strategy, strategy. You should have done it this way, this way, this way. More than, it seems to me, oftentimes, anything like the common good. We can't even define the common good here, and I'm not sure you did in your talk. So I'd love to hear you talk about that, but also what prevents us even from debating the common good, because we're just constantly talking strategy now in the political culture.
You know, on the subject of humility and reporters, first of all, there are plenty of people on the Twittersphere and who reply to my column who would disagree with you that I'm humble. And so, but I appreciate it anyway. No, I always say that one of my favorite emails that I could actually repeat to a polite audience that was in criticism began, "Dear Mr. Dion, are you as dumb in person?" And I like to quote that when I give talks, because I can then say, you know, if you get nothing else out of what I say, you'll at least be able to answer the question for yourself. But, and it's about our mutual friend David Brooks actually writing a book about humility, and he was talking about the nature of media that if he really wanted to make the point, that the cover of the book would have humility in really small letters and the name David Brooks in really large type on the front. You know, it's... I've thought a lot about that line from Pope Francis, you know, the person who claims to have all the answers, God is not with that person. But then I asked myself, what would it be like if a pundit went on one of these shows and answered a whole slew of questions I don't know? They would never be asked back again, and I wouldn't blame a producer for not asking them back again. So in a way, there is a curious obligation to authority or to pretend to authority when you're sort of put in that situation, although I've always believed in both politics and the media that the occasional I don't know is actually an extremely useful answer, not as an evasive answer, but an answer that doesn't get you into trouble. If you actually don't know, it's rather dangerous on some subjects to go on as if you do, but also as a form of solidarity with an audience, where an audience, I find it myself that I really respect people in the media, in politics, who occasionally give, I don't know, as an answer. In terms of strategy in the horse race, on the one hand, obviously I agree with you, there is, you know, this has gotten to such a point that I'll never forget a Boston Globe story on a debate in a Massachusetts Senate race where the Boston Globe was going to asking voters what they made of the debate. And one of the voters they asked gave an absolutely perfect pundit's answer in the debate. You know, I can't remember who it was. We'll say Romney did what he needed to do and then sort of explain. And his answer had nothing to do with how the debate affected him as a citizen. But all he was doing is doing an excellent job. In fact, it was probably as good as anything a pundit said on television, mimicking a politics where democratic politics is a spectator sport, not a participatory
sport. Sounds like David Gergen to me.
So I do think there is a problem there. And Todd Gitlin, who teaches at Columbia, once said that in the absence of a vital polis, they take polls. And while I love opinion polls, my column tomorrow, I should confess, is about why Obama is where Obama is losing ground and where he can recapture some. And it's very poll-driven. I suggest he's facing his winter of, the media are saying he's facing his winter of discontent and it's not even winter yet. So where is the but? In terms of the definition of the common good, I'm not gonna take a good stab at that right now, though I think that there is some combination of a sort of utilitarian view. It marries a utilitarian view, but with another view, but the utilitarian view of the best for the most, basically. But that's not sufficient. I think that a common good view also talks about creating the beloved community, or what Glenn Tinder, who speaks down the street at BU, likes to talk about as the attentive society. And some of you may know this, but you know, Glenn Tinder talks about the attentive society as a place that leaves room for strong conviction, but where all citizens realize the obligation both to give and to receive help on the road to truth. And I love that idea. And it's a very Catholic view because it's not relativist. It asserts that there is truth, but it acknowledges the need for citizens to come to each other's aid. And it implies a kind of humility that says, I need your help to find the right answer, and you need my help to find the right answer. So I think the attentive society and the beloved community, to me, combine, give us a clue as to where to find the common good.
Go ahead.
Hi, Dan Sullivan. I would like to know if you see the trajectory for the Tea Party going forward. Is this going to become a cornerstone of our political system, or is it going to fall on its own abilities? What is its trajectory?
When you said your name was Dan Sullivan, I happened to be in Dublin the last few days. I came back on Sunday, and you can tell I grew up here in Massachusetts because I said, I love walking around Dublin. All the names are American. I personally think the Tea Party has hit the peak and is on the decline, for which, and I've been pretty sort of out front about that and have had a lot of people argue with me on this assertion. I think the results of the elections this month are a bad sign for them. I mean, three election results. One in Virginia, where Ken Cuccinelli's ties to the Tea Party, I think, clearly did hurt him. And while a lot was made of Terry McAuliffe not winning by the margin he had in some of the polls, and maybe the party should have given him more support, party didn't give him more support, partly because they saw his weakness as a Tea Party candidate. And also, the Tea Party won in 2010 under very particular circumstances, which is that you had a real disengagement of the, depending on how you want to describe it, the Obama or the progressive constituency. And I thought what was striking about this time is that a combination of organizing and fear of a particularly right-wing candidate changed the electorate from 2009 into something that looked much more like a general election electorate. And in anything that looks like a broader electorate, the Tea Party is going to run into trouble because it's a more diverse electorate. It's a younger electorate. Actually, in that one case, I think the electorate wasn't particularly young in Virginia, but it was much more diverse. And so I think that showed a problem. Christie's victory is seen in part, and I think legitimately, as the product of somebody who was willing to distance himself from that sort of politics. I actually think Chris Christie is a lot more conservative than either conservatives or media commentators allow. Nonetheless, he was very open about not being one of them, the guys who shut the government in Washington. And then, you know, Bill de Blasio's victory was a victory for a populist left in New York. Now, whether the problems of Obamacare continue and whether they can reignite a kind of energy on the right, I kind of doubt it. And I also think that the Tea Party issues have run out of steam. It is not that we will not have people of those views. There has always been 20% of Americans who have been quite far out on the right end of the political spectrum. And this goes all the way back to, you know, the folks who were sympathetic to the Liberty League during the New Deal, and it goes back to the, you know, at the extreme to the Birch Society founded down the street in Belmont. So you've always had, so those views aren't going to go away. But I think their influence, especially after this election and the shutdown, I think their influence is going to decline. And if I prove wrong, Alan, you can have me back and have me publicly flogged for bad predictions. You know, we pundits are lucky we never have to face that sort of punishment.
On this side of the room, any questions? Because we have Lori Patton. Okay, go ahead, Lori. Oh, I didn't see you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, we'll do next.
So thank you
for your presentation, by the way.
Oh, I appreciate yours immensely, as the previous speaker did. So we should have talked about this earlier in the day, and we haven't. And so I thought you would be a perfect person to think with us about this. And that is the question of gender and women and politics and religion. And
that's the first time a woman has ever told me that I'd be the perfect person to think about this. I love you too.
I'm all about alliance, right? So the way that I think about this now, if you take the two themes that we've been just talking about, you raised the beautiful example of the prophet or what a prophet is earlier in your talk, or the question of humility and arrogance. So just looking at how our language is constrained around religion and women in public life, a male prophet, we don't even say male prophet, but assuming that prophet is male, tends to be moral, tends to be very much confrontative, but grounded in some way. And if you think about the English language usage of female prophet, it tends to be a soothsayer, right? Not all the time, but there is that sort of very interesting common language usage.
Book of Wisdom, is that an exception?
Possibly. Yeah. Just English language, though. If you think of a humble man, they get credit. If you think of a humble woman, you think of someone who is lowly, frequently. Not always. But the point is that we have a set of habits of thinking about women in public life that I don't think we're completely over yet. American political world, we elected an African-American before we elected a woman. That doesn't mean that we couldn't have. But I think it's a very interesting question of, you talked earlier about how earlier candidates could and could not perform religious identity in American political life. We have one example, Sarah Palin, who performed religious identity in a way that was not terribly convincing to most folks, but to some. And so I'm just wondering if you could think a little bit with us about how you see women religion in public life, women candidates in the future, trends given where we are, because it is something that I think is a huge issue in American religion more broadly that we need to address.
You know, I should sort of maybe for truth in packaging note that I actually, when Benedict resigned, I wrote a piece for the Washington Post Outlook section on why we should elect a nun as pope, which you can imagine went over better in certain parts of the church than in other parts of the church. And also, I do think there are, you know, that it's still new enough that there are challenges to women. So, I mean, it's if a woman is too strong, she's strident. If she is humble, she's not strong enough to be president. And there are all kinds of lines that women have to walk. Just to show we have made progress, in the early 80s, there was a race in a Democratic primary where a woman called Evelyn Gandy was the front runner. She was running way ahead. And one of the male candidates, figured they got to pull her back, and they thought the woman issue was the only way to pull her back. And they actually ran this great ad, it's scurrilous ad, but it was an ad where the ad began, the governor of Mississippi is also the commander-in-chief of the Mississippi National Guard. And it showed people shooting at a National Guard rifle range. And it was all directed against Evelyn Gandy for being a woman, and she started dropping in the polls. And the candidate realized that if he kept the ad on the air, she wouldn't even make the runoff. So he pulled the ad, she just made the runoff, and then he ran the ad again and just knocked her out of the election. So I think we made a little progress from there. But I've always wondered whether this is something peculiar about us or kind of accident. Why did Margaret Thatcher get elected in Britain before a woman got elected president of the United States? There is no liberal progressive woman I know had Margaret Thatcher as their ideal for the first woman president of the United States. And actually, it's given me the notion that it's quite possible although I actually think Hillary Clinton would be favored if she were nominated the next time. If not that, I've often wondered if the first woman elected president of the United States would actually be a Republican, precisely because there would be a kind of crossover to the other side. But, you know, the last thing I'll say, I'm the parent of a son and two daughters, and you think a lot about the assumptions that are in the heads of, Americans under 30, under 20. They are hugely different than the assumptions that were in our heads. They are so radically different. Like a lot of proud papas, I told one of my girls when she was about 6 or 7 that she could be the first woman president of the United States, and she looked at me and said, "Dad, why will it take that long?" Which made me think, maybe she will be the first, but I think that "Dad, why will it take that long?" question from her is the kind of question that would occur to a generational woman that might not have occurred to them before. Beyond that, much of my wisdom comes from those two daughters. At the risk of sounding like Jimmy Carter in that debate, if you remember when he quoted Amy on nuclear policy, but I think this is safer.
Speaking about how far we've come, the story you told doesn't rival the one I'm sure you know, that when George Smathers ran against Claude Pepper for the Senate nomination, the Democratic Party in Florida in 1950, he said that his opponent had a thespian, who was a sister who was a thespian in New York.
and it was true.
I think we only have time, Kay.
Yes, you on women in politics.
Yes, we have the world's leading authority
as
on
opposed
the
to
questions.
A pundit.
Hi,
this is
my name is Kay Schlossman. I'm the Moakley Professor in the Political Science Department, and I've taught a course called Gender and Politics since the late 1970s. So I just want to add a little bit of what EJ likes so much, and that's data. So I have nothing to say about the question about how would men and women candidates deal with the religious question and so forth. But I can add a few things about why is the United States 79th in the world rankings about gender equality in politics. And there's a whole lot of answers why American democracy, which in a lot of ways paved the way, is 79th. And one of them is a kind of boring institutional thing that political scientists talk about, and that is that we're a presidential democracy with single-member districts, and the democracies that have multi-member districts and many parties and a party list find it easier to elect women because you get to vote for a whole bunch of candidates, you vote for the party list, and then if in your district they get to elect 10 candidates, maybe the woman will be number 3 and 4 and 5, and if they get that proportion of the vote, then you elect more to the legislature. So it's not just that we don't look like the Philippines or Indonesia or Sri Lanka, all of which have had women heads of government, but that the proportion of women in our national legislature is really pretty low. And there's this institutional explanation. One thing that EJ was talking about was how the media and candidates treat male and female candidates differently, and that's true. But I want to make a plea for American voters who, in fact, don't. That some of the explanations as to why we have so few women candidates have to do with the party leaders and party activists and party influentials. If you run for office, one of the biggest spurs is getting asked. And the party influentials, who are disproportionately male, are much more likely to urge and ask male potential candidates than female potential candidates. And that has a real impact on what the pool looks like. And to finish that story, it turns out that in the last 20 years, there's a partisan gap in that, and that Republicans are especially unlikely to ask female potential candidates to run for office. But when there are male and female candidates on the ballot, American voters respond to their, quote, political characteristics. That is, they vote for the candidates of the party they identify with. If they're Republicans, they vote for Republicans, whether male or female. Similarly, if they are Democrats, the independents don't split their vote on the basis of the gender of the candidate. Furthermore, incumbents have an advantage, but again, the incumbents are disproportionately likely to be male if we have a legislature that's only 20% female. So those are some of the additional things I would just throw into EJ's answer.
Could I ask a question, Kay?
Just, sure.
Because it's always struck me that another factor, women made a significantly greater progress in American politics at the state legislative and local level than they had at the national level. Is that accurate? In other words, you've seen, you're getting closer to 50-50 in state legislatures, city council. No, it's still not, or it varies by state.
Here's what it looks like, and the data are really complicated. There used to be a circumstance where, in a sense, the higher up you went up the federalism chain, the greater, the smaller the proportion of women. So more in the city councils than in the state legislatures than in the national legislature. Well, one thing that happened in the late 90s is that the proportion of women in the state legislatures got to the low 20s, sort of 23, 24, and then it just leveled off, and it really hasn't changed. So as now that the proportion of women in the national legislatures, I think 17 in Congress and 20 in the Senate, there's been some convergence there, and we don't really know why. The one place where women approach parity is school boards.
Yes. And it's remarkable how many women who rise higher up started out in school board politics.
The other thing is that there are more women in legislative than executive office. That's a tougher hill to climb for female candidates.
Could I just on the side of hope on this for people who would like to see women rise all the way to the top, which is if you sit around and just make your list of potential Democratic nominees over the next two elections, it is remarkable how many of your potential candidates are women, because it's not only Hillary Clinton, who is the prohibitive front runner at the moment for 2016. It's also Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was, as some of you know, in the New Republic this week, shown to be the only plausible, competitor to Hillary Clinton in 2016. You've got people like Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand. I think that again, Kay, you can correct me, but I think it's highly unlikely on the Democratic side that we will ever see a presidential election in which there is not a serious woman candidate. I mean, that's a crazy prediction because a lot of who becomes a candidate depends on a lot of things. But when you look at the talent pool coming up, it's striking how many women are in that group. And I think they've got staying power, a lot of these women.
Well, this is a terrifically interesting question, but I'm afraid that we have to use this room for other purposes. I'm going to have to call it in. But Professor DeYoung, what a great pleasure to have you at the best Jesuit university in America.
Second best.
Right. So we're having a reception, and the reception's going to be on the side rooms here, right here. Please, you're all welcome to join us. You have a question for this man? You'll be able to ask it there.
For the sake of my employment at Georgetown, I do want it recorded that I question that very last statement that Alan made about the best Jesuit university in America. Thank you.
All right, the best in Massachusetts.
Yeah.